12 and would continue until 8.
You ever hear anything like it?
He alone in there?
Yeah. Few people come in, but they couldn't take it neither. Man, you should have seen their faces when they come out. Give you the creeps.
Shit, man,
Cecily said. She was the ticket seller and worked in the booth out front.
I couldn't stand to sit through 2 minutes of that movie, all them dead folks and such.
Lordy,
I sold that guy his ticket 3 shows ago.
He come out, bought a large Coke and buttered popcorn, tipped me a buck. But I tell you, I almost didn't want to touch the money. It looked greasy or something.
Bastard's probably playing with hisself in there, probably looking at all them dead, messed up faces and playing with hisself. Somebody ought to go in there and tell him to...
The laughter swelled again. Emiliano flinched. The noise now reminded him of the cry of a boy he'd once gut-stabbed in a knife fight. The laughter broke and burbled, became a soft cooing that made Cecily think of the sounds the addicts made in the shooting gallery she frequented. Her face was frozen until the laughter went away, and then she said,
"I believe I've got things to do."
She turned away and hurried to the ticket booth, where she locked the door. She'd figured that the guy inside the theater was going to be weird when she saw him. He was a big, husky, Swedish-looking man with curly blonde hair, milk-white skin, and eyes like cigarette burns. As he bought his ticket, he'd stared holes through her and never said a word.
Weird,
she thought, and she picked up her People magazine with trembling fingers.
Come on, 8 o'clock, Emiliano pleaded.
He checked his wristwatch. In a few minutes, The Face of Death, Part 4, would be ending, and Willie, the old drunk of a projectionist, would be changing the reels upstairs for Mondo Bizarro, which showed bondage scenes and such. Maybe the guy would leave when the picture changed. Emiliano sat on his stool and continued reading his Conan comic book, trying to shut off the bad memories that had been stirred up by the laughter from within. The red curtains moved. Emiliano hunched his shoulders as if about to be beaten. Then the curtains parted, and the man who liked movies emerged into the dingy lobby.
He's leaving, Emiliano almost grinned, his gaze glued to the comic book. He's going out the door.
But the man who liked movies said in a soft, almost childlike voice,
I'd like a large Coke and a tub of buttered popcorn, please.
Emiliano's stomach clenched. Without letting himself look into the man's face, he got off his stool, drew the Coke into a cup from the dispenser, got the popcorn, and splashed butter into it.
More butter, please,
the man who liked movies requested. Emiliano gave the popcorn another drool of butter and slid it and the Coke across the counter.
$3, he said.
A $5 bill was pushed toward him.
Keep the change, the man said, and this time his voice had a southern accent.
Startled, Emiliano looked up. The man who liked movies stood about 6'4" and was wearing a yellow T-shirt and green khaki trousers. Under thick black eyebrows, his eyes were hypnotically green against the amber hue of his flesh. Emiliano had already figured him to be South American as soon as he'd walked in, maybe with some Indian blood in him, too. The man's hair was black and wavy, cut close to the skull. He stared fixedly at Emiliano.
I want to see the movie again, he said quietly, and his voice carried what might have been a Brazilian accent again.
Mondo Bizarro's about to come on in a couple minutes. Projection guys probably got the first reel on.
No,
the man who liked movies said, and he smiled slightly.
I want to see that movie again right now.
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, I don't make the decisions here, right? You know, I just work behind the counter. I don't have any say-so.
And then the man reached out and touched Emiliano's face with cold, butter-smeared fingers, and Emiliano's jaw seized up as if it had frozen solid. The world seemed to spin around him for a second, and his bones were a cage of ice. Then he blinked, and his whole body trembled, and he was standing behind the counter, and the man who liked movies was gone.
Damn, he thought. Bastard touched me!
He grabbed a paper napkin and wiped his face where the fingers had been, but he could still feel the chill they'd left. The $5 bill remained on the countertop. He put it in his pocket and came out from behind the counter, and he peeked through the curtains into the theater. On the screen, in glorious and gory color, were blackened corpses being pulled from the wreckage of cars by firemen. The narrator was saying, "Face of death will pull no punches. Everything you see will be real. If you are in any way squeamish, you should now be on your way out." The man who liked movies was sitting in the front row. Emiliano could see the outline of his head against the screen. The laughter began, and as Emiliano backpedaled away from the curtains, he looked dumbly at his wristwatch and realized that almost 20 minutes of his life was a black hole. He went through a door and up a flight of stairs to the projection booth, where Willie sat sprawled on a couch reading Hustler.
"Hey," Emiliano said, "what's going on, man? How come you showing that shit again?"
Willie stared at him for a moment over the edge of the magazine.
"You lost your marbles, kid," he inquired. "You and your friend just come up here and asked me to. Wasn't 15 minutes ago, so I put it back on. Don't mean shit to me one way or the other. Anyway, I don't argue with no old perverts."
"Old perverts? What are you talking about, man?"
"Your friend," Willie said. "Guy must be 70 years old. Beard makes him look like Rip Van Winkle. Where do these perverts come from?"
"You're crazy," Emiliano whispered.
Willie shrugged and returned to his reading. Outside, Cecily looked up as Emiliano ran into the street. He glanced back at her, shouted,
"I ain't staying in there. No way. I quit,"
and ran away along 42nd Street and into the gloom. Cecily crossed herself, rechecked the lock on the ticket booth's door, and prayed for dawn. In his seat in the front row, the man who liked movies dug a hand into his buttered popcorn and stuffed his mouth full. Before him were scenes of broken bodies being extracted from the rubble of a London building bombed by Irish terrorists. He cocked his head to one side, appreciating the sight of crushed bones and blood. The camera, blurred and unsteady, focused on the frantic face of a young woman as she cradled a dead child. The man who liked movies laughed as if he were watching a comedy. In the sound of that laughter was the shriek of napalm bombs, incendiary rockets, and tomahawk missiles. It echoed through the theater, and if other people had been sitting there, each one would have squirmed with the memory of a private terror. And in the reflected light from the screen, the man's face was undergoing a transformation. No longer did he look Swedish or Brazilian, or have a gray Rip Van Winkle beard. His facial features were running together like the slow melting of a wax mask. The bones shifting beneath the skin, the features of 100 faces rose and fell like suppurating sores. As the screen showed an autopsy in close-up progress, the man clapped his hands together with merry glee. "Almost time," he thought. "Almost time for the show to start." He'd been waiting a long time for the curtain to rise, had worn many skins and many faces, and the moment was soon, very soon. He'd watched the lurch toward destruction through many eyes, had smelled fire and smoke and blood in the air like intoxicating perfumes. The moment was soon, and the moment would belong to him. Oh, yes. Almost time for the show to start. He was a creature of patience, but now he could hardly keep himself from dancing. Maybe a little Watusi up the aisle would be in order. And then he'd slam dance that cockroach behind the candy counter. It was like waiting for a birthday party, and when the candles were lit, he would rear his head back and roar loud enough to stagger God. Almost time. Almost time. And where would it start, he wondered. Who would push the first button, no matter? He could almost hear the fuse crackling and the flame drawing near. It was the music of the Golan Heights, of Beirut and Tehran and Dublin and Warsaw, Johannesburg and Vietnam. Only this time, the music would end in a final deafening crescendo. He stuffed popcorn into a mouth that opened greedily on his right cheek. Party down, he thought. And he giggled with a noise like grinding glass. Last night, he'd stepped off a Trailways bus from Philadelphia and, strolling down 42nd Street, had seen that this film was playing. He took the opportunity to admire his performances in The Face of Death, Part 4, whenever he could. Just in the background, of course, always part of the crowd. But he could always recognize himself. There was a good shot of him standing over a mass of corpses after the bombing of an Italian soccer stadium, looking suitably shocked. Another brief glimpse showed him wearing a different face at an airport massacre in Paris. Lately, he'd been on tour, riding the bus from city to city, seeing America. There were so many terrorist groups and armed firebrands in Europe that his influence was hardly needed. Though he'd enjoyed helping plant that nice potent bomb in Beirut. He'd stayed a while in Washington, but none of the theaters were showing The Face of Death Part 4 there. Still, Washington held so many possibilities. And when you mixed and mingled with Pentagon boys and cabinet members at some of those parties, you never knew what you might stir up. It was all coming around to him now. He sensed the nervous fingers hovering near red buttons all over the world. Jet pilots would be scrambling, submarine commanders would be listening to their sonars, and old lions would be eager to bite. And the amazing thing was that they were doing it all themselves. It almost made him feel useless. But his starring role was coming around very soon. His only concern was that it wouldn't be finished yet. Not even with all the lightning soon to strike. There might still be pockets of humanity left and small towns struggling to survive in the dark like rats in a collapsed basement. He understood very well that the firestorms, the whirlwinds of radiation and black rain would destroy most of them, and the ones that remained would wish they were dead 1,000 times over. And in the end, he would walk Tusi on their graves, too. It was almost time. Tick, tock, tick, tock, he thought. Nothing ever stops the clock. He was a patient creature, but it had been a long wait. A few more hours would only whet his appetite, and he was very, very hungry. For the time being, he could enjoy watching himself in this fine film. Curtains going up, he thought. And the mouth in the center of his forehead grinned before it disappeared into the flesh like a gray worm in damp ground. It's showtime. Chapter 7. 10:16 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, New York City. A blue light was spinning. Cold rain came down, and a young man in a yellow rain slicker reached out his arms. "Give her to me, lady," he said, his voice as hollow as if he were speaking from the bottom of a well. "Come on, let me have her." "No!" Sister Creep shouted, and the man's face fragmented into pieces like the shattering of a mirror. She thrust out her hands to push it away, but then she was sitting up, and the nightmare was whirling away in pieces like silver bats. The sound of her cry echoed back and forth between the walls of rough gray brick, and she sat staring at nothing for a moment as the sputtering of nerves shook her body. "Oh," she thought when her head cleared, "that was a bad one." She touched her clammy forehead, and her fingers came away damp. "That was close," she thought. The young demon in the yellow raincoat was there again, very near, and he almost got my... She frowned. Got my what? The thought was gone now. Whatever it had been, it had flipped over in the dark side of her memory. She often dreamed of the demon in the yellow raincoat, and he was always wanting her to give him something. In the dream, a blue light was always flashing, hurting her eyes, and rain was hitting her in the face. Sometimes the surroundings seemed terribly familiar, and sometimes she almost knew what it was he wanted. But she knew he was a demon, or probably the devil himself, trying to pull her away from Jesus, because her head pounded so badly after the dream was over. She didn't know what time it was or whether it was day or night, but her stomach was rumbling with hunger. She had tried to sleep on a subway bench, but the noise of some shouting kids scared her, so she trundled off with her bag in search of a more secure place. She'd found it at the bottom of a ladder that descended in a darkened section of subway tunnel. About 30 feet beneath the main tunnel was a drainage pipe, large enough for her to move through if she stooped over. Dirty water streamed past her sneakers, and the tunnel was illuminated by an occasional blue utility lamp that showed the network of cables and pipes just overhead. The tunnel shook with the thunder of a subway train passing, and Sister Creep realized she was under the rails. But as she continued along the tunnel, the noise of the trains faded to a polite, distant growl. She soon found evidence that this was a popular place for members of the ragtag nation. A beat-up old mattress pushed back into a cubbyhole, a couple of empty wine bottles, and some dried human excrement. She didn't mind. She'd seen worse. And so she'd slept on the mattress until the nightmare of the demon in the yellow raincoat had awakened her. She was hungry, and she decided she'd climb back up to the subway station to search for scraps in the garbage cans. Maybe try to find a newspaper, too, to see if Jesus had come while she was sleeping. Sister Creep stood up, put the strap of her bag around her shoulder, and left the cubbyhole. She started back along the tunnel, tinged by the dim blue glow of the utility bulbs, and hoped she'd find a hot dog today. She'd always been fond of hot dogs, with plenty of good spicy The tunnel suddenly trembled. She heard the sound of concrete cracking. The blue lamps flickered, went dark, and then brightened again. There was a noise like the howl of wind or a runaway subway train speeding overhead. The blue lamps continued to brighten until the light was almost blinding, and Sister Creep squinted in the glare. She took 3 more uncertain steps forward. The utility bulbs began to explode. She put her hands up to shield her face, felt pieces of glass strike her arms, and she thought with sudden clarity, I'll sue somebody for this. In the next instant, the entire tunnel whipped violently to one side, and Sister Creep fell into the stream of dirty water. Chunks of concrete and rock dust cascaded from the ceiling. The tunnel whipped back in the other direction with a force that made Sister Creep think her insides were tearing loose, and the concrete chunks hit her head and shoulders as her nostrils filled with grit. Lord Jesus, she shouted, about to choke. Oh, Lord Jesus! Sparks shot overhead as the cables began to rip free. She smelled the wet heat of steam and heard a pounding noise like the footsteps of a behemoth treading above her head. As the tunnel pitched and swayed, Sister Creep clung to her bag, riding out the gut-twisting undulations, a scream straining behind her clenched teeth. A wave of heat passed over her, stealing her breath. God help me, she shrieked in her mind as she struggled for air. She heard something pop and tasted blood streaming from her nose. I can't breathe, oh sweet Jesus, I can't breathe. She gripped at her throat, opened her mouth, and heard her own strangled scream wail away from her through the shivering tunnel. Finally, her tortured lungs dragged in a breath of scorched air, and she lay curled up on her side in the darkness, her body racked with spasms and her brain shocked numb. The violent twisting motion of the tunnel had stopped. Sister Creep drifted in and out of consciousness, and through the haze came the distant roar of that runaway subway train again, only now it was getting louder.
Get up, she told herself. Get up, it's judgment day, and the Lord has come in his chariot to take the righteous up into the rapture.
But a calmer, clearer voice spoke, perhaps from the dark side of her memory, and it said, bullshit. Something bad's happened up there.
Rapture, 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 she thought, forcing the wicked voice away.
She sat up, wiped blood from her nose, and drew in steamy, stifling air. The noise of the runaway train was closer. Sister Creep realized that the water she was sitting in had gotten hot. She grasped her bag and slowly rose to her feet. Everything was dark, and when Sister Creep felt the tunnel's walls, her fingers found a crazy quilt of cracks and fissures. The roaring was much louder, and the air was heating up. The concrete against her fingers felt like city pavement at noon in August, ready to fry eggs sunny side up. Far away, along the tunnel, there was a flicker of orange light, like the headlamp on a speeding subway train. The tunnel had begun to tremble again. Sister Creep stared, her face tightening as the orange light grew brighter, showing streaks of incandescent red and purple. She realized then what it was, and she moaned like a trapped animal. A blast of fire was roaring toward her along the tunnel, and she could already feel the rush of air being sucked into it as if into a vacuum. In less than a minute, it would be upon her. Sister Creep's trance snapped. She turned and fled, holding her bag close, her sneakers splashing through steaming water. She leaped broken pipes and pushed aside fallen cables with the frenzy of the doomed. She looked back and saw the flames shooting out red tendrils that snapped in the air like whips. The vacuum suction pulled at her, trying to draw her backward into the fire, and when she screamed, the air sizzled in her nostrils and at the back of her throat. She could smell burning hair, felt her back and arms rippling with blisters. In maybe 30 seconds, she'd be joining her lord and master, and it astounded her that she wasn't ready and willing to go. With a startled cry of terror, she suddenly tripped and fell headlong to the floor. As she started to scramble up, she saw she tripped over a grate into which the stream was draining. Beneath the grate was only darkness. She looked at the onrushing fire, and her eyebrows singed. Her face broke into oozing blisters. The air was unbreathable. There was no time to get up and run. The fire was almost upon her. She gripped the bars of the grate and wrenched upward. One of the grate's rusted screws snapped, but the second held tight. The flames were less than 40 feet away, and Sister Creep's hair caught fire.
"God, help me!" she screamed inwardly, and she pulled upward on the grate so hard she felt her shoulders almost rip loose from their sockets. The second screw snapped.
Sister Creep flung the grate aside, had a second to grab her bag, then lunged headfirst into the hole. She fell about 4 feet into a coffin-sized space that held 8 inches of water. The flames passed overhead, sucking the air from her lungs and scorching every inch of her exposed skin. Her clothes burst into flame, and she rolled frantically in the water. For a few seconds, there was nothing but the roaring and the agony, and she smelled the odor of hot dogs being boiled in a vendor's cart. The wall of fire moved on like a comet, and in its wake returned a whoosh of outside air that carried the thick smell of charred flesh and molten metal. Down in the hole that fed drainage water to a sewer pipe, Sister Creep's body hitched and contorted. 3 inches of water had risen as mist and evaporated, blunting the full force of the fire. Her burned, tattered body struggled for a breath and finally gasped and sputtered, the blistered hands tightly gripping her smoldering canvas bag. And then she lay still.
Chapter 8. 8:31 a.m. Mountain Daylight Time. Blue Dome Mountain, Idaho. The steady buzzing of the telephone on the table beside his bed brought the man up from a dreamless sleep. Go away, he thought. Leave me alone. But the buzzing continued, and finally he slowly turned over, switched on the lamp, and, squinting in the light, picked up the receiver.
"Macklin," he said, his voice slurred and sleepy.
Colonel, sir," it was Sergeant Shore. "I've got some people in orientation waiting to meet you, sir." Colonel James Jimbo Macklin looked at the little green alarm clock next to the phone and saw he was more than 30 minutes late for the orientation and handshaking session. "Damn it to hell," he thought. "I set that alarm for 06:30 sharp."
"All right, Sergeant. Keep them there another 15 minutes.
He hung up and then checked the back of the alarm clock. He saw that the little lever was still pressed down. Either he'd never set the alarm or he'd turned it off in his sleep. He sat on the edge of the bed trying to summon the energy to get up, but his body felt sluggish and bloated. Years ago, he mused grimly, he'd never needed an alarm clock to wake him. He could have been snapped out of sleep by the sound of a footstep in wet grass, and he would have been as alert as a wolf within seconds. Passing time, he thought, long gone. He willed himself to stand up, willed himself to walk across the bedroom, its walls decorated with photographs of Phantom and Thunder Chief jets in flight, and walked into the small bathroom. He switched on the light and ran water into the sink. It came out rusty. He splashed the water on his face, dried himself with a towel, and stood staring bleary-eyed at the stranger in the mirror. Macklin stood 6'2", and until 5 or 6 years ago, his body had been lean and hard, his ribs covered with muscle, his shoulders strong and straight, his chest thrust out like Cobham armor on the snout of an M1 tank. Now, the definitions of his body were blurred by loose flesh, and his pot belly resisted the 50 sit-ups he did every morning, that is, when he had the time to do them. He detected a stoop in his shoulders as if he were being bowed by an invisible weight, and the hair on his chest was sprinkled with gray. His biceps, once rock-hard, had deteriorated into flab. He'd once broken the neck of a Libyan soldier in the crook of his arm. Now he didn't feel as if he had the strength to crack a walnut with a sledgehammer. He plugged in his electric razor and guided it over the stubble on his jaw. His dark brown hair was clipped in a severe crew cut, showing flecks of gray at the temples. Beneath a square slab of a forehead, his eyes were frosty blue and sunken in deep hollows of fatigue, like bits of ice floating on muddy water. As he shaved, Macklin thought that his face had come to resemble any one of the hundreds of battlefield maps he'd pored over long ago, the jutting cliff of his chin leading to the rugged ravine of his mouth, up to the highlands of his chiseled cheekbones and the craggy ridge of his nose, down again into the swamps of his eyes, then an upward sweep into the brown forests of his thick eyebrows. And all the terrain marks were there as well. The pockmarked craters of the severe acne he'd had as an adolescent, the small trench of a scar zigzagging through his left eyebrow, compliments of a ricocheting bullet in Angola. Across his left shoulder blade was a deeper and longer scar carved by a knife in Iraq, and a reminder of a Viet Cong bullet puckered the skin over the right side of his rib cage. Macklin was 44 years old, but sometimes he awakened feeling 70, with shooting pains in his arms and legs from bones that had been broken in battles on distant shores. He finished shaving and drew aside the shower curtain to run the water, then he stopped. Because littering the bottom of the small shower stall were ceiling tiles and bits of rubble. Water was dripping from a series of holes where the shower stall ceiling had given way. As he stared at the leaking water, realizing he was running late and couldn't take a shower, anger suddenly rose within him like molten iron in a blast furnace. He slammed his fist against the wall once, and then again. The second time, the force of his blow left a network of minute cracks. He leaned over the sink, waiting for the rage to pass, as it usually did. "Steady," he told himself. "Discipline and control. Discipline and control." He He repeated it a few more times, like a mantra, drew a long, deep breath, and straightened up. Time to go, he thought. They're waiting for me. He used his stick deodorant under his arms, then went out to the bedroom closet to choose his uniform. He picked a pair of crisply pressed dark blue trousers, a light blue shirt, and his beige poplin flight jacket with leather patches on the elbows and Macklin printed across the breast pocket. He reached up to the overhead shelf where he kept a case containing his Ingram gun and ammo clips and lovingly took his Air Force colonel's cap down. He brushed an imaginary bit of lint off the polished brim and put the cap on his head. He checked himself in the full-length mirror on the back of the closet door. Buttons polished, check. Trousers creased, check. Shoes shining, check. He straightened his collar, and then he was ready to go. His private electric cart was parked outside his quarters on the command center level. He locked his door with one of the many keys he carried on a keychain, then got into the cart and drove along the corridor. Behind him, past his own quarters, was the sealed metal door of the weapons storage room and the emergency food and water supply. Down at the other end of the corridor, past the quarters of other Earth House technicians and employees, was the generator room and the air filtration system controls. He passed the door of perimeter control, which contained the screens of the small portable battlefield surveillance radars set out to guard the entry to Earth House, and the main screen of the skyward-trained radar dish that sat atop Blue Dome Mountain. Within perimeter control was also the hydraulic system that sealed the air vents and the lead-lined doorway in the event of a nuclear attack, and the various radar screens were manned around the clock. Macklin guided the cart up a ramp to the next level and headed for the town hall. He passed the open doors of the gymnasium where an aerobics class was in session. A few morning joggers were running in the corridor, and Macklin nodded to them as he sped past. Then he was in the wider corridor of Earth House's town square, a junction of hallways with a rock garden at its center. All around were various shops with storefronts made to resemble those in a country town. Earth House's town square contained a tanning salon, a theater where videotaped movies were shown, a library, an infirmary staffed by a doctor and two nurses, a game arcade, and a cafeteria. Macklin caught the aroma of bacon and eggs as he drove past the cafeteria's doors and wished he'd had time for breakfast. It was not his way to be late. Discipline and control, he thought, those were the two things that made a man. But he was still angry about the collapsed ceiling in his shower stall. Lately, it seemed that the walls and ceiling in several areas of Earth House were cracking and giving way. He'd called the Ausley brothers many times, but they told him the structural reports showed settling was to be expected. "Settling my ass," Macklin had said. "We've got a water drainage problem here. Water's collecting over the ceilings and leaking through." "Don't get yourself in a dither, Colonel," Donnie Ausley had told him from San Antonio. "If you get nervous, them folks are going to get nervous, right? And there ain't no sense in getting nervous, 'cause that mountain's been standing for a few thousand years and it ain't going nowhere." "It's not the mountain," Macklin had said, his fist tightening around the receiver. "It's the tunnels. My cleanup crews are finding new cracks every day." "Settling, that's all. Now listen, Terry and me have pumped about 10 million big ones into that place, and we built it to last. If we didn't have business to run, we'd be right there with you. Now, that far underground, you're going to have some settling and water leaks. Ain't no way around it. And we're paying you $100,000 a year to endorse Earth House and live down there, you being a big war hero and all. So you fix them cracks and keep everybody happy." "You listen, Mr. Ausley. If I don't get a structural engineer to look this place over within a week, I'm leaving. I don't give a damn about my contract. I'm not going to encourage people to stay down here if it's not safe." "I believe," Donnie Ausley had said, his Texas accent getting a few degrees cooler,
You'd better calm yourself down, Colonel. Now, you don't want to walk out on a business deal. That ain't good manners. You just remember how Terry and me found you and brought you along before you start flying off the handle. Okay. Discipline and control, Macklin had thought, his heart hammering. Discipline and control. And then he'd listened as Donnie Ostley had told him he'd send an engineer up from San Antone within 2 weeks to go over Earth House with a fine-tooth comb. The meantime, you're head honcho. You got a problem, you fix it, right? And that had been almost a month ago. The structural engineer had never come. Colonel Macklin stopped his cart near a pair of double doors. Above the doors was the sign, Town Hall, in ornate, old-timey lettering. Before he went in, he tightened his belt another notch, though the trousers were already squeezed around his midsection. Then he drew himself up tall and straight and entered the auditorium. About a dozen people sat in the red vinyl seats that faced the podium, where Captain Warner was answering questions and pointing out features of Earth House on the wall map displayed behind him. Sergeant Shore, who stood ready to field the more difficult questions, saw the colonel enter and quickly stepped to the podium's microphone. "Excuse me, Captain," he said, interrupting an explanation about the plumbing and water filtration system. "Folks, I want to introduce you to someone who certainly needs no introduction. Colonel James Barnett Macklin." The colonel continued at a crisp pace along the center aisle as the audience applauded. He took his place behind the podium, framed by an American flag and the flag of Earth House, and looked out at the gallery. The applause went on, and a middle-aged man in a camouflage combat jacket rose to his feet, followed by his similarly dressed wife. Then all of them were standing and applauding, and Macklin let it continue for another 15 seconds before he thanked them and asked them to be seated. Captain Teddy Bear Warner, a husky ex-Green Beret who'd lost his left eye to a grenade in the Sudan and now wore a black patch, took a seat behind the colonel, and Shore sat beside him. Macklin paused, gathering in his mind what he was going to say. He usually gave the same welcoming speech to all the new arrivals at Earth House, told them how secure the place was and how it would be the last American fortress when the Russians invaded. Afterward, he took their questions, shook their hands, and signed a few autographs. That was what the Ostley boys paid him for. He looked into their eyes. They were used to nice clean beds, sweet-smelling bathrooms, and roast beef on Sunday afternoons. Drones, he thought. They lived to breed and eat and shit, and they thought they knew all about freedom and loyalty and courage, but they didn't know the first thing about those attributes. He cast his gaze over the faces, saw nothing but softness and weakness. These were people who thought they'd sacrifice their wives and husbands, infant children, homes, and all their possessions as the price of keeping the Russian filth off our shores, but they would not, because their spirits were weak and their brains were corrupted by mental junk food. And here they were, like all the others, waiting for him to tell them they were true patriots. He wanted to open his mouth and tell them to get the hell out of Earth House, that the place was structurally unsound, and that they, the weak-willed losers, ought to go home and cower in their basements. Jesus Christ, he thought. What the hell am I doing here? Then a mental voice, like the sound of a cracking bullwhip, said, "Discipline and control, shape up, mister." It was the voice of the Shadow Soldier. Macklin closed his eyes for a second. When he opened them, he was staring into the face of a bony, fragile-looking boy sitting in the second row between his father and mother. A good strong wind would knock that kid to the ground, he decided. But he paused, examining the boy's pale gray eyes. He thought he recognized something in those eyes. Determination, cunning, willpower, that he remembered from pictures of himself at that age, when he was a
fat, clumsy slob that his Air Force captain father had kicked in the ass at every opportunity. Of all of them sitting before me, he thought, that skinny kid might have a chance. The others were dog meat. He braced himself and started giving the orientation speech with as much enthusiasm as if he were digging a latrine ditch. As Colonel Macklin spoke, Roland Kroninger examined him with intent interest. The colonel was a lot heavier than the photographs in Soldier of Fortune, and he looked sleepy and bored. Roland was disappointed. He'd expected a trim and hungry war hero, not a used car salesman dressed up in military duds. It was hard to believe that this was the same man who had shot down 3 MiGs over the Ten Hoa Bridge to save a buddy's crippled plane and then had ejected from a disintegrating aircraft. Rip-off, Roland decided. Colonel Macklin was a rip-off, and he was beginning to think Earth House might be a rip-off as well. That morning he'd awakened to find a dark water stain on his pillow. The ceiling was leaking from a crack 2 inches wide. There'd been no hot water from the shower head, and the cold water was full of grit and rust. His mother had thrown a fit about not being able to get her hair clean, and his father had said he'd mentioned the problem to Sergeant Shore. Roland was fearful of setting up his computer because the air in his bedroom was so damp. And his first impression of Earth House as a neo-medieval-type fortress was wearing thin. Of course, he'd brought books to read, tomes on Machiavelli and Napoleon, and a study of medieval siege warfare, but he'd counted on programming some new dungeons for his King's Knight game while he was here. King's Knight was his own creation. 128K of an imaginary world shattered into feudal kingdoms at war with one another. Now it looked as if he was going to have to read all the time. He watched Colonel Macklin. Macklin's eyes were lazy, and his face was fat. He looked like an old bull that had been put out to pasture because he couldn't get it up anymore. But as Macklin's eyes met his and held for a couple of seconds before they slid away again, Roland was reminded of a picture he'd seen of Joe Louis when the boxing champion had been a Las Vegas hotel greeter. In that picture, Joe Louis looked flabby and tired, but he had one massive hand clasped around the frail white hand of a tourist, and Joe Louis's eyes were hard and dark and somewhere far away, maybe back in the ring, remembering the feel of a blow slammed against another man's midsection almost to the backbone. Roland thought that the same distant stare was in Colonel Macklin's eyes, and just as you knew Joe Louis could have smashed the bones in that tourist's hand with one quick squeeze, Roland sensed that the warrior within Colonel Macklin was not yet dead. As Macklin's address continued, the wall telephone beside the display map buzzed. Sergeant Shore got up and answered it. He listened for a few seconds, hung the receiver up, and started back across the platform toward the colonel. Roland thought that something in Shore's face had been altered in the time he was on the telephone. Shore appeared older now, and his face was slightly flushed. He said, "Excuse me, Colonel," and he placed his hand over the microphone. Macklin's head snapped around, his eyes angry at the interruption. "Sir," Shore said quietly, "Sergeant Lombard says you're needed in perimeter control."
"What is it?"
"He wouldn't say, sir. I think he sounded pretty damn shaken."
"Crap," Macklin thought. Lombard got shaken every time the radar picked up a flock of geese or an airliner passing overhead. Once, they'd sealed Earth House because Lombard thought a group of hang gliders were enemy paratroopers. Still, Macklin would have to check it out. He motioned for Captain Warner to follow him, and then he told Shore to dismiss the orientation after they'd gone.
"Ladies and gentlemen," Macklin said into the microphone, "I'm going to have to leave you now to take care of a small problem, but I hope to see each of you later this afternoon at the newcomers' reception. Thank you for your attention." And then he stalked up the aisle with Captain Warner right behind him. They drove back in the electric cart the way Macklin had come,
Macklin muttering all the way about Lombard's stupidity. When they went into the perimeter control room, they found Lombard peering into the screen that showed the returns from the sky radar atop Blue Dome. Near him stood Sergeant Becker and Corporal Prados, both staring at the screen as well. The room was full of electronic equipment, other radar screens, and the small computer that stored the arrival and departure dates of Earthhouse's residents. On a shelf above a row of radar screens, a voice was blaring from a shortwave radio, almost obscured by the crackling of static. The voice was panicked, babbling so fast Macklin couldn't understand what was being said. But Macklin didn't like the sound of it, and instantly his muscles tensed and his heart began to pound. "Move aside," he told the other men. He stood where he could get a good look at the screen. His mouth went dry, and he heard the sizzling of circuits in his own brain at work. "God in heaven," he whispered. The garbled voice from the shortwave radio was saying, "New York got it. Wiped out. The missiles are coming in over the East Coast. Hit Washington, Boston. I can see flames from here." Other voices surged out of the storm of static, bits and pieces of information hurtling along the network of ham radio operators across the United States and picked up by Blue Dome Mountain's antennas. Another voice with a southern accent broke in, shouting, "Atlanta just went dead. I think Atlanta got hit." The voices overlapped, swelled, and faded, commingled into a language of sobs and shouts, weak, faint whispers, and the names of American cities repeated like a litany of the dead. Philadelphia, Miami, Newport News, Chicago, Richmond, Pittsburgh. But Macklin's attention was fixed on what the radar screen showed. There could be no doubt about what they were. He looked up at Captain Warner and started to speak, but he couldn't find his voice for a second. Then he said, "Bring the perimeter guards in, seal the doorway. We're under attack. Move it." Warner picked up a walkie-talkie and hustled off. "Get Shore down here," Macklin said, "and Sergeant Becker, a loyal and reliable man who had served with Macklin and Chad." Instantly picked up the telephone and started pressing buttons. From the shortwave radio, a frantic voice said, "This is KKTZ in St. Louis, calling anybody. I'm looking at a fire in the sky. It's everywhere. God almighty, I've never seen such a..." A piercing squeal of static and other distant voices flooded into the empty hole left by St. Louis. "This is it," Macklin whispered. His eyes were shining, and there was a light sheen of sweat on his face. "Ready or not, this is it." And deep inside him, in the pit where no light had shone for a very long time, the Shadow Soldier cried out with joy. Chapter 9. 10:46 a.m. Central Daylight Time on Interstate 70, Ellsworth County, Kansas. 24 miles west of Salina, Josh Hutchins' battered old Pontiac gave a wheeze like an old man with phlegm in his lungs. Josh saw the temperature gauge's needle zoom toward the red line. Though all the windows were lowered, the inside of the car felt like a steam bath, and Josh's white cotton shirt and dark blue trousers were plastered to his body with sweat. "Oh, Lord," he thought, watching the red needle climb. "She's about to blow." An exit was coming up on the right, and there was a weathered sign that said, "Pawpaws, gas, cold drinks, 1 mile," and had an exaggerated drawing of an old geezer sitting on a mule smoking a corncob pipe. "I hope I can make another mile," Josh thought, as he guided the Pontiac onto the exit ramp. The car kept shuddering, and the needle was into the red, but the radiator hadn't blown yet. Josh drove northward, following Pawpaw's sign, and before him, stretching to the horizon, were immense fields of corn grown to the height of a man and withering under the terrible July heat. The two-lane county road cut straight across them, and not a puff of breeze stirred the stalks. They stood on both sides of the road like impenetrable walls, and might have gone on, as far as Josh knew, for 100 miles, both east and west. The Pontiac wheezed and gave a jolt. "Come on," Josh urged, the sweat streaming down his face. "Come on, don't give out on me now." He didn't relish the idea of walking a mile in 100-degree sun. They'd find him melted into the concrete like an ink blot. The needle continued its climb, and red warning lights were flashing on the dashboard. Suddenly, there was a crackling noise that made Josh think of the Rice Krispies he used to like as a kid. And then, in the next instant, the windshield was covered with a crawling brown mass of things. Before Josh could finish drawing a surprised breath, a brown cloud had swept through the open windows on the Pontiac's right side, and he was covered with crawling, fluttering, chattering things that got down the collar of his shirt, into his mouth, up his nostrils, and in his eyes. He spat them from his mouth and clawed them away from his eyes with one hand while the other clenched the steering wheel. It was the most ungodly noise of chattering he'd ever heard, a deafening roar of whirring wings. And then his eyes cleared, and he could see that the windshield and the car's interior were covered with thousands of locusts, swarming all over him, flying through his car and out the windows on the left side. He switched on the windshield wipers, but the weight of the massive locusts pinned the wipers to the glass. In the next few seconds, they began flying off the windshield, first 5 or 6 at a time, and then suddenly, the whole mass in a whirling brown tornado. The wipers slapped back and forth, smearing some unlucky ones who were too slow, and then steam billowed up from under the hood and the Pontiac Bonneville lurched forward. Josh looked at the temperature gauge. A locust clung to the glass, but the needle was way over the red line. "This sure isn't turning out to be my day," he thought grimly as he brushed the remaining locusts from his arms and legs. They, too, whirred out of the car and followed the huge cloud that was moving over the sunburned corn, heading in a northwesterly direction. One of the things flew right up in his face, and its wings made a noise like a Bronx cheer before it darted out the window after the others. Only about 20 or so remained in the car, crawling lazily over the dashboard and the passenger seat. Josh concentrated on where he was going, praying that the engine would give him just a few more yards. Through the cloud of steam, he saw a small, flat-roofed cinder-block structure coming up on his right. Gas pumps stood out front under a green canvas awning. On the building's roof was a full-sized old Conestoga wagon, and printed in big red letters on the wagon's side was Pawpaw's. He breathed a sigh of relief and turned into the gravel driveway, but before he could reach the gas pumps and a water hose, the Pontiac coughed, faltered, and backfired at the same time. The engine made a noise like a hollow bucket being kicked, and then the only sound was the rude hiss of steam. "Well," Josh thought, "that's that." Bathed in sweat, he got out of the car and contemplated the rising plume of steam. When he reached out to pop the hood open, the metal burned his hand like a bite. He stepped back, and as the sun beat down from a sky almost white with heat haze, Josh thought his life had reached its lowest ebb. A screen door slammed.
"You got yourself some trouble?"
a wizened voice inquired. Josh looked up. Approaching him from the cinder block building was a little hump-backed old man wearing a sweat-stained 10-gallon hat, overalls, and cowboy boots.
"I sure do," Josh replied.
The little man, who stood maybe 5'1", stopped. His 10-gallon hat, complete with a snakeskin hatband and an eagle's feather sticking up, almost swallowed his head. His face was as brown as sun-baked clay, his eyes dark, sparkling dots.
"Hey," he rasped. "You're a big un, ain't you? Lordy, I ain't seen one as big as you since the circus passed through."
He grinned, revealing tiny nicotine-stained teeth.
"How's the weather up there?"
Josh's sweaty frustration tumbled out in a laugh. He grinned widely as well.
"The same as down there," he answered. "Mighty hot." The little man shook his head in awe and walked in a circle around the Bonneville. He too attempted to get the hood up, but the heat stung his fingers.
"Hose is busted," he decided. "Yep, hose. Seen a lot of them lately."
"Do you have spares?" The man tilted his neck to look up, still obviously impressed with Josh's size.
"Nope," he said. "Not a one. I can get you one, though. Order it from Selena. Should be here in, 2 or 3 hours."
"2 or 3 hours? Selena's only about 30 miles away." The little man shrugged.
"Hot day. City boys don't like hot days. Too used to air conditioning. Yep. 2 or 3 hours will do it."
"Damn. I'm on my way to Garden City."
"Long drive," the man offered. "Well, we'd best let her cool off some. I got cold drinks if you want one."
He motioned for Josh to follow and started toward the building. Josh was expecting a tumble-down mess of oil cans, old batteries, and a wall full of hubcaps, but when he stepped inside, he was surprised to find a neat, orderly country grocery store. A throw rug had been put down right at the doorway, and behind the counter and cash register was a little alcove where the man had been sitting in his rocking chair watching television on a portable Sony. Now, though, the TV screen showed only static.
"Things went out on me just before you drove up," he said. "I was watching that show about the hospital and them folks always getting in trouble. Lord God, they'd put you under the jail around here for some of them shenanigans."
He cackled and took off his hat. His scalp was pale and he had white hair that stood up in sweat-damp spikes.
"All the other channels are off, too, so I guess we got to talk, huh?"
"I guess so." Josh stood in front of a fan atop the counter, letting the deliciously cool air separate his wet shirt from his skin. The little man opened a refrigerator unit and brought out 2 canned Cokes. He handed one to Josh, who snapped the tab and drank thirstily.
"No charge," the man said. "He looked like you've had a rough morning. My name's Papa Briggs." "Well, Papa ain't my real name. It's what my boys call me, so that's what the sign says."
"Josh Hutchins." They shook hands, and the little man grinned again and pretended to wince under the pressure of Josh's grip. "Do your boys work here with you?"
"Oh, no," Papa chuckled. "They got their own place, up the road 4 or 5 miles.
Josh was grateful to be out of the hot sun. He walked around the store, rolling the cold can across his face and feeling the flesh tighten. For a country store out in the middle of a cornfield, he realized after another moment, the shelves of Papa's place held an amazing variety of items. Loaves of wheat bread, rye bread, raisin bread, and cinnamon rolls, cans of green beans, beets, squash, peaches, pineapple chunks, and all kinds of fruit. About 30 different canned soups, cans of beef stew, corned beef hash, spam, and sliced roast beef, an array of utensils, including paring knives, cheese graters, can openers, flashlights and batteries, and a shelf full of canned fruit juices, Hawaiian punch, Welch's grape juice, and mineral water in plastic jugs. A rack on the wall held shovels, picks, and hoes, a pair of garden shears, and a water hose. Near the cash register was a magazine stand displaying periodicals like Flying, American Pilot, Time and Newsweek, Playboy, and Penthouse. This place, Josh thought, was the supermarket of country stores.
"Lot of people live around here," Josh asked.
"Few."
Papa whacked the TV with his fist, but the static remained.
"Not too many."
Josh felt something crawling under his collar. He reached back and dug out a locust.
"Things are hell, ain't they?" Papa asked. "Get into everything they do. Been flying out of the fields by the thousands for the last 2-3 days. Kind of peculiar."
"Yeah." Josh held the insect between his fingers and went to the screen door. He opened it and flicked the locust out. It whirled around his head for a couple of seconds, made a soft, churring noise, and then flew toward the northwest. A red Camaro suddenly pulled off the road, swerved around Josh's sick Bonneville, and halted at the pumps.
"More customers," Josh announced.
"Well, well, we got us a regular convention today, don't we?"
He came around the counter to stand beside Josh, barely the height of Josh's breastbone. The doors of the Camaro opened, and a woman and a little blonde-haired girl got out.
"Hey,"
the woman, who was squeezed into a red halter top and tight, uncomfortable-looking jeans, called toward the screen door.
"Can I get some unleaded gas here?"
"Sure can."
Papa went outside to pump the gas for. Josh finished his Coke, crumpled the can, and dropped it into a wastebasket. When he looked through the screen door again, he saw that the child, who wore a little powder blue jumpsuit,